She won't be
Our centennial commemorations of the First World War have been subtly influenced by continuing doubts in some quarters about whether Britain should have joined the fray in 1914. Given these doubts, then might not the opponents of that war have been in the right? In which case, weren't the introduction of conscription in 1916 and the subsequent treatment of conscientious objectors also open to criticism? Such reasoning must explain why I have been invited so often during the last year to talk about different aspects of opposition to the 1914-18 war. Indeed, several commemorative events have been devoted exclusively to pacifism, with particular reference to that conflict. But I confidently predict, given the overwhelming consensus that fighting Hitler was the right thing to do, that when all of us here reconvene in a quarter of a century's time to commemorate British intervention in the Second World War, conscription and conscientious objection during 1939 to 45 will get significantly less of a look-in. My argument today about the First World War will be that far too negative a spin has been placed on Britain's record regarding conscription and conscientious objection, which, by comparative standards, was exceptionally enlightened. During the 19th century, conscription, the requiring of most young males to undertake military service so as to be available rapidly to constitute a trained mass army in the event of war, had become the norm for great powers. Indeed, it had become almost the badge of modernity for a self-respecting state. Yet Britain had moved serenely in the opposite direction, allowing its historic militia obligation to become a dead letter from the 1830s. Mary Tudor's 1558 Militia Act, which finally scrapped feudal military obligations, had created an in-principle universal obligation to defend the realm. After some abysmal performances by this militia against Monmouth's rebellion in 1685 and the Jacobites in 1745, it was overhauled by the 1757 Militia Act, which required a universal ballot of able-bodied men, though it allowed the well-off to buy themselves out of the new militia by paying a £10 fine or hiring a substitute, a concession which I mention here because it is relevant to the later part of my story today. The new militia was not particularly effective, though. During the invasion panics that marked the long French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, it had to be supplemented at local level by a volunteer movement, which operated independently of government control. As the British political system liberalised during the post-Napoleonic peace, the Great Reform Act of 1832 gave the vote to the middle classes, but not to the artisans. The latter, understandably, took up the cry of no vote, no musket, and as many also turned to Chartism, the militia ballot became a political impossibility. Aversion to compulsion continued even after urban artisans gained the vote in 1867 and rural artisans in 1884. Despite a burgeoning empire to defend and a unified and industrializing Germany to constitute a threat, compulsory military service remained politically a non-starter, as even Tory governments recognized. Even after Britain entered the First World War in August 1914, and after Conservatives joined the government in May 1915, the Liberal leadership mostly regarded conscription as industrially and politically unworkable. The recently published diary of the Prime Minister's wife, Margot Asquith, contains the following account of a train journey she took on the 20th of August 1915 in the company of Walter Runciman, the Liberal President of the Board of Trade, who obviously managed to get quite a lot of words in edgeways. Quote, "He is madly opposed to conscription and pointed out all the follies with great clearness and precision. We could not afford to take more than 800,000 men away from imperative war work, even if we could equip them. There would be a fiendish outcry. None of the exempt industries, miners, engineers, or railwaymen, would be bought off. They would stand by their forced fellows and cry out as loud as the rest. No compulsion for foreign service was feasible. Voluntary heroes and conscript laggers could not and would not fight side by side. The whole problem was far too complicated to be workable, and most important of all, there would be strikes all over the country. Margot added, and heavily underlined, "I agree with every word he said, and I'm sure Henry does also." Henry, of course, being her husband, the Prime Minister. Indeed, Asquith was careful to make clear that his opposition to conscription was not based on principle, telling the Commons on the 2nd of November 1915, "I have no abstract or a priori objection of any sort to compulsion in time of war." He insisted that it was based on likely popular hostility. Quote, "Compulsion under present conditions would forfeit what I regard to be of supreme and capital importance, namely the maintenance of the national unity." But just 23 days later, on the 25th of November 1915, the electors in Merthyr Tydfil, the mining seat which had previously returned the socialist pioneer Keir Hardie of the ILP, chose a pro-conscription working man standing as an independent in a straight fight with the ILP's pro-war but anti-conscription candidate. The Merthyr Tydfil by-election of the 25th of November 1915 thus knocked the stuffing out of Runciman's and Asquith's claim that the workers would not accept conscription. It suggested instead that many of them thought conscription socially fairer than voluntary recruitment. Consequently, in January 1916, conscription for married men was introduced. And, despite Asquith's efforts to hold the line there, in May 1916, married men were also required to serve. After a century of being out of step, Britain had fallen into line with the generality of major states. Yet that generality of conscripting states had always ignored pacifists. And during 1914 to 18, most combatant countries that resorted to conscription, including advanced democracies such as France, made no provision whatsoever for conscientious objection, and indeed were not to do so for another half century. Only four countries, all English-speaking, made any sort of provision. Of these, three, the United States, Canada, and New Zealand, provided for exemption on conscientious grounds only from bearing arms. They required even those recognized as conscientious objectors to join the armed forces, albeit in a non-combatant role. And those same three, the United States, Canada, and New Zealand, recognized as conscientious objectors only members of historic peace sects, such as Mennonites and Quakers. They did not regard a Christian, however saintly, from a mainstream church or denomination as entitled to exemption from bearing arms. Still less did they regard someone whose scruples were non-religious as entitled to any such exemption. In Britain, by contrast, legislative provision was made in the Military Service Acts of 1916 for total exemption on grounds of conscience. That is, not only from bearing arms, but also from doing other non-combatant military service, or indeed from performing any other form of alternative service to the state. And, no less remarkably, legislative provision was made for those whose conscientious claims for such an exemption were derived from membership of historic peace sects, but also from any other religious beliefs. Finally, and most extraordinarily of all, legislative provision was also made for those whose conscientious scruples were explicitly non-religious. Britain's statutory provisions for conscientious objection were thus, by world historical standards, astonishingly generous and constituted a testament to what a Liberal Party can achieve, even when it is in coalition with Conservatives, as was the case in 1916. Yet this astonishing generosity has rarely been recognised, as popular history has instead focused primarily on the conflict between a minority of disgruntled objectors and the local tribunals set up to assess their conscientious claims. Those tribunals were, of course, caught between a state that had decided to be tolerant and a civil society that had its own notions of fairness, as the Merthyr Tydfil by-election had shown. Until recently, at least, the verdict of British history has sympathised more with the disgruntled objectors than with the tribunals, which have become, as the subtitle of a recent revisionist book puts it, a very much abused body of men. Likewise, it has often at least implicitly disparaged British civil society during the First World War as blimpishly vindictive. My own view is that this is unfair on both the tribunals and civil society, which were both comparatively tolerant in difficult circumstances. Why was Britain so late to introduce conscription and so well disposed to conscientious objectors during the First World War? I offer both a general and a particular answer. The general answer can be found in the combined effect of geography and political culture, which had given Britain a stronger peace movement than elsewhere, and therefore more potential conscientious objectors. The particular answer can be found in the way in which the Quakers had responded to Britain's militia system. I argue that Britain's geographical position was distinctive in what I have called its semi-security, and that Britain's political culture was distinctive in what I have called its semi-liberalism. First, geography. Historically, geography conditioned how favourably countries viewed the chances of improving international relations. Insecure countries, those with easily crossable land borders, as in much of continental Europe, were pessimistic. They assumed that the only way to deter aggression was through the time-honoured policy of maintaining strong defences and military alliances, according to the time-honoured doctrine, if you want peace, prepare for war. Such countries believed, in other words, that an armed truce between prepared and watchful countries was the best that the international system could ever realistically hope for. To believe more optimistically that war could either be renounced absolutely or reformed out of existence, as peace movements did, required a degree of security from the constant fear of invasion, of the kind that the English Channel and the Royal Navy provided for insular Britain. But almost total security from invasion, the kind the United States enjoyed in its hemisphere, enabled a country simply to opt out of international conflicts rather than work to prevent them. Hence America's famous isolationism between the 20th century's world wars. Despite occasional 19th century talk of splendid isolation, Britain could not simply wash its hands of international relations, as it might have wished, because it was only semi-secure. The English Channel was too narrow to provide total immunity from invasion or blockade, however strong the Royal Navy. And in addition, Britain had an extensive empire to defend. Its diplomats and peace activists therefore worked hard to prevent the outbreak of the European and global wars into which it risked being dragged, as of course it was in August 1914. In other words, a semi-secure country like Britain was endowed by geography with enough security to be optimistic about improving international relations, but not with so much security that it could simply opt out of international relations altogether when the going got tough. Political culture has been almost as important as geography in conditioning attitudes to international relations. Britain's long-standing constitutionalism, Protestantism, particularly the nonconformist variety, and commercialism, plus its 19th century espousal of free trade and its gradual democratisation, all combined to encourage free criticism of government policies, including foreign and defence policy, unfettered campaigning by voluntary associations on moral issues, including peace, and smooth integration of an emerging working class political movement into national life. So entrenched did liberalism become in 19th century Britain that despite the economic challenge to Britain's position from the United States and Germany, protectionism proved an electoral liability. So did conscription. This liberal element within Britain's political culture found some echoes on the maritime fringes of Northern Europe, namely in the Low Countries and Scandinavia, but it found almost none in the political culture of the heartland of continental Europe, which was Catholic, Lutheran, or Orthodox in its social and political values, protectionist in its economics, and conscriptionist in its military arrangements. Legal restrictions on freedom of association and freedom of speech made it hard for peace societies to form and operate. Political dissent was therefore largely confined to a working class which, because of its social and political alienation, was drawn to Marxist or anarchist forms of protest rather than to the constructive moderation of Britain's Labour Party. But I describe British political culture as only semi-liberal. This was because it retained a conservative strand which, though inherited from a feudal past and seriously challenged by the 19th century rise of economic and political liberalism, remained influential. Consequently, conservative notions that foreign policy should be based on national interest and balance of power acted as a check on liberal notions that foreign policy should be based only on morality and international law. The United States, by contrast, had an almost wholly liberal political culture. As a settler society, it had not evolved out of a feudal order, and as a constitutional project, it was self-consciously liberal. The disadvantage from a pacifist perspective of a wholly liberal political culture unchecked by conservative realism was a greater propensity to moralistic crusades, such as America's war against Spain in 1898, or indeed its war against Saddam Hussein in 2003. Another characteristic of liberal settler societies without traditional elites has been an intolerance of dissenting minorities. Such societies, which in their formative periods need to pull together to survive, have expected their citizens to go along with majority decisions. They have therefore viewed the refusal to do so not as the legitimate invocation of human rights against an abstract entity such as the state or the crown, but as an affront to civil society itself. The intensity of America's various Red Scares, of which the most famous was the McCarthyism of the early 1950s, has illustrated this. So, my argument is that semi-liberal cultures have had sufficient liberalism to allow the diffusion of dissenting ideas, but not so much as to indulge in moralistic or populist excesses. A semi-secure geographical position and a semi-liberal political culture are thus, in my view, the major reasons why Britain developed the world's first and strongest peace movement, why it held out for so long against conscription, and why it made comparatively generous provision for conscientious objection when it finally gave in during 1916. But there is a more particular factor which legitimated conscientious objection in Britain, the distinctive behaviour of the Religious Society of Friends, better known as the Quakers. Pacifism of the absolute variety originated in the rejection by absolutist sects of many worldly practices of mainstream Christian society, including the bearing of arms. But different pacifist sects behaved differently and therefore produced different reactions from the political systems they were defying. In particular, the Mennonites and the Quakers adopted different approaches, which explain why during the First World War, the handful of states that recognized conscientious objection did so in two different ways. The Mennonites, who appeared in 16th century continental Europe, were the pacifist wing of the more famous and sometimes apocalyptically violent Anabaptists. The Quakers, one of the many revolutionary English groups spawned in the 17th century crisis created by the deposition of Charles I, declared themselves non-resistant in 1661 as a prudent response to the restoration of Charles II. Dealing, as the Mennonites of Europe had to, with illiberal regimes, they prudently cut deals with political authorities, who for their part realized that it was a waste of time trying to coerce religious fundamentalists that, aside from their refusal to fight, were disciplined and dutiful. For pragmatic reasons, therefore, the Habsburg emperors allowed their Mennonite subjects to serve in auxiliary medical units rather than bear arms, and the Russian Tsars allowed their Mennonites to serve in forestry camps rather than in the army. The Mennonites thus served their state dutifully and even contributed to its capacity to sustain a military effort, though they did not themselves fight. The many Mennonites who migrated to North America found that they were sometimes required to undertake militia service and made clear that for religious reasons they would not do so. But on the British militia model, they found that exemption was available in return for paying a fine or hiring a substitute soldier. For the most part, North American Mennonites accepted this escape route, therefore, thereby shaping mainstream society's view of pacifism. The evident religious sincerity of the Mennonite rejection of personal military service undoubtedly helped to create an expectation that a liberal country should not compel historic peace sects to fight, which is why during the First World War, the United States, Canada, and also New Zealand exempted such sects from bearing arms. But by paying for others to do combatant service in their place, Mennonites seem not to mind if others went to war on their behalf. Their absolutism appeared, therefore, as a request for special exemption from military service on account of their own superior religious scruples. The job of fighting could be left to those with less exacting spiritual vocations. Indeed, Mennonites sometimes gave the impression that they were happy to be fought for by others. To the extent that Mennonites did not regard other Christians as capable of rising to the same religious standard, and even did not want them to do so, their absolutism can be described as exemptionism rather than true pacifism. Because Mennonites thus seemed interested only in their own exemption and seemed to accept the combatant effort as undertaken by others, the United States, Canada, and New Zealand offered exemption only from bearing arms. Their historic peace sects were thus let off killing, but were expected to do non-combatant service in the army and to support the military effort in other ways. By contrast, in Britain, the most influential pacifist sect, the Quakers, had implacably refused any deals over militia service. They consistently turned down the opportunity to pay £10 fines or hire militia substitutes, as offered in the 1757 Militia Act, although an increasingly prosperous sect could have afforded to do so. Instead, Quakers suffered much more costly and damaging seizures of their property when they refused either to serve or pay up. Their willingness in this way to suffer for their absolutist principles gradually won the admiration of many of their fellow citizens. So too did their presenting of pacifism not as the birthright privilege of people born like themselves into a historic peace sect, but as a point of view which all true Christians should embrace, even if it left the country defenceless. They thus appeared to be true pacifists as distinct from mere exemptionists. Quakers thus had a moral influence out of all proportion to their numbers, which dwindled to below 20,000. Indeed, after observing Quaker refusal of militia service, a few mainstream British Christians, Congregationalists, Baptists, and even Anglicans, also began to profess pacifism. The first tracts arguing that the absolute rejection of all war was a duty for all Christians and not merely for those belonging to particular sects were published in London in 1796. This was the decade during which the world's first peace movement appeared in Britain to oppose the country's involvement in the French Wars. After the end of those wars, in 1816, the Peace Society was established in London by Quaker and non-Quaker Christians on an equal footing. It became the world's strongest absolute pacifist organization for almost 100 years. Indeed, it was only in the last 2 months of 1914 that the Peace Society was in effect superseded by two new British absolutist associations created in response to the First World War. The No Conscription Fellowship, for those deriving their pacifism from socialism, and the Fellowship of Reconciliation, for those deriving it from Christianity. The Peace Society's loss of vitality, harshly exposed by the First World War, reflected the growing acculturation of many Quakers, who by the late 19th century increasingly attended mainstream schools and universities, and often thereafter ceased to be pacifists. Indeed, the formation in 1888 of a Friends Peace Committee to promote the traditional Quaker peace testimony within the Society of Friends, sometimes taken by historians as a sign of an intensifying pacifism, was in fact the exact opposite. It showed that support for pacifism was by all Quakers could no longer be taken for granted. The drift of some members away from traditional beliefs led others, active in a so-called Quaker Renaissance, to affirm their faith in an uncompromising fashion. By the time of the First World War, the Society of Friends had two distinct wings. Lapsed pacifists who supported the war, such as the liberal politician J.A. Pease, who stayed in the government and instead resigned his presidency of the Peace Society, and the members and supporters of the Friends Service Committee, founded in May 1915, which advocated conscientious objection of the most intransigent kind. Official Quaker figures later showed that as many as 33.6% of its military-age males undertook military service, and that fewer than half, namely 44.5%, became conscientious objectors. The drift of the Society of Friends away from 100% loyalty to their peace testimony was ironic, given that Quakers had done so much to legitimise pacifism and conscientious objection in Britain. As well as ignoring the comparative generosity of the provision for objectors, historians have, at least until recently, presented a negative view of their treatment by the authorities and by fellow citizens. Only 16,500 Britons claimed a conscientious objection to conscription during the First World War. The Second World War figure was to be almost four times higher at 60,000, though popular history has largely overlooked these pacifists of 1939 to 45. And as many as four-fifths of the 16,500 First World War objectors were granted some kind of exemption by their military service tribunal. The difficulties between objector and tribunal, upon which historians have often focused, arose in two circumstances. The first difficulty occurred when the one-fifth who had their conscience claims rejected outright were then inducted into the army. A hard core of these refused even to put on military uniform, and in a major public relations blunder by the British Army during May and June 1916, 34 of these were transferred to France, where disobeying military orders in the face of the enemy could trigger a death sentence. But no such sentence was carried out. Indeed, such objectors were soon transferred from the army into civil prisons, where their claims for conscientious objection were reconsidered by a central tribunal. And with flexibility now being shown on both sides, most objectors accepted work of national importance outside the army. The number of recalcitrants who remained was as small as 313. The second and more significant problem occurred when the objectors who'd been given some level of exemption by their tribunal held out for a higher one. When it drafted the conscientious clauses of its military service acts, the Asquith coalition government seems to have assumed, along with civil society in general, that most objectors would be satisfied with being released from the obligation to kill. It expected only an exceptional few to seek release even from non-military work of national importance and hold out for total exemption. 450 objectors were held to be exceptional and were granted total exemption by their tribunals, most of them, understandably, given the high esteem in which they were held, Quakers. But, using the freedoms of a remarkably unrepressive country, the No Conscription Fellowship, with Bertrand Russell playing a leading role, and the Friends Service Committee, persuaded many more objectors than had been predicted to hold out for total exemption. Thus, though given limited exemption, some 985 unconditionalists insisted on total exemption and therefore went to prison rather than do alternative work of national importance. A handful of these were high-profile idealists, such as the future politicians Clifford Allen and Fenner Brockway, and the saintly Balliol-educated social worker Stephen Hobhouse. Their well-publicised prison sufferings led in November 1917 to a coalition government package deal whereby most such conditionalists were released from prison on health grounds, but all conscientious objectors forfeited the right to vote in parliamentary elections for 5 years. Clifford Allen, Fenner Brockway and Stephen Hobhouse have been presented in the popular historical literature as not just exemplary, but typical, but this is wrong. The commonest single type of objector was not a Quaker or a serious-minded member of either the No Conscription Fellowship or the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Instead, he was a simple religionist, characterized, as the most detailed study has put it, by literal biblicism, sectarian withdrawal, and apocalyptic expectations. Nor should British civil society be judged too harshly for its treatment of pacifists. Yes, there are occasional mobs, usually incited by the right-wing press, which attack public meetings, and warders who behave cruelly towards imprisoned objectors. But the No Conscription Fellowship itself pointed out that of Britain's first 400 conscientious objectors, only 22 abandoned their stand in the face of hostility. By contrast, in the United States, a staggering 4/5 of objectors inducted into the army to undertake non-combatant service gave in and agreed to perform combatant duties, in some cases becoming war heroes. This was not merely because American pacifists were more inclined to compromise, though this does indeed seem to have been the case. More importantly, it was because the disapproval they received from their fellow citizens was so much more intense. Indeed, America's intolerant mood can be judged by the public's widespread acquiescence in the May 1918 Sedition Act that, for all the country's much vaunted constitutional protections, in effect suspended free speech. So, to conclude, my talk has noted how the low reputation of the First World War has led to considerable and often uncritical interest in the conscientious objectors to that conflict. I have preferred today to emphasize Britain's extraordinary generosity in not only recognizing conscientious objection, but catering for non-sectarian and even non-religious objectors, and in principle allowing them total exemption. That generosity, I've argued, owed much to Britain's semi-secure geographical situation and semi-liberal political culture, which together had made the country a world leader in pacifism, as well as to the historical refusal of British Quakers to seek special favours for themselves. Thank you.